Hi everyone, welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. I'm Langdon DeMint.
And I'm Julian Taylor.
And welcome to our podcast.
Welcome to Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. And this week we've really gone for it big style. We've actually got three bald guys talking safety. I've got my good friend Langdon here. Langdon, how are you?
I'm good.
And we're joined today by actually a friend of mine, Matt Gibson. So welcome to Three Bald Guys Talking Safety, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
You're not our typical guest, other than in hairstyle.
Bald, welcome.
Bald, so very welcome. Yeah. Because your day job is not safety.
That's
Your day job is very much, I suppose, I will let you introduce yourself, but mechanical engineering, but you have a bent towards safety. So I suppose the best thing to do is let you introduce yourself, a bit about your background and what you do currently.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. So my background is I spent about 20 years working initially as a mechanical engineer, but working in a number of different parts of the oil and gas industry. And then for the last 5 years, I'm working in a consulting environment. So I'm spending quite a bit of my time either delivering training courses or also coaching and working on consulting projects, generally with major maintenance activities. So I work not as a direct kind of in the safety kind of environment, but I work in a very high hazard environment for most of what I'm doing. So I'm having to be very much aware of safety around me with the various activities that are going on.
I suppose one thing we hadn't talked about, but you've obviously been in the industry for 20 years. What sort of changes have you seen in that time around safety and I suppose the discussion of safety around the activities that you get involved with?
So I've seen a huge amount of changes, and not so much necessarily all happening at the same time. And the advantage of what I'm doing now, I'm going in seeing lots of different people, and they're all just on different stages of a safety journey. So in my kind of personal career, I guess I saw when I first joined, there was a fairly big focus around things like slips, trips and falls and that kind of side of safety. And then a real appreciation around process safety, a major kind of hazard analysis and that sort of thing started to come on. And then at the latter point of my employee career, it very much phased into things like behavioral safety and kind of understanding things from that perspective. I guess when I left my employer and went into consulting, I then started to understand actually other people were at very different stages of that journey. And especially as I travel around the world, I see people, moving on in different places from that point.
Okay. And that's interesting, isn't it? I was going to sort of get into it later, but I suppose that sort of cultural thing around safety in different regions, what's your experiences with that? And even in some of the sort of less, I suppose, I was going to use the term educated, that's maybe the wrong word, but less aware countries, what's their sort of openness to conversations around safety?
I think it very much changes. So some are very open, some are very aware of where they are on their safety journey. Others, which are probably the more kind of scary side of things, are those who just are not aware of how bad they actually are at that point. Maybe they're hiding behind certain safety statistics, which might, for whatever reason, look fairly good. But underlying that is still kind of, they are very kind of naive in terms of where they currently are. So there's a real big range. And it's not necessarily specifically about location. You kind of see different stages in different in the same place as well.
And one of the big things that we always talk about, you always talk about turnarounds. So for the sake of our sort of the people who listen to the podcast, when we're talking about a turnaround, just give us an overview of what we actually mean by that term.
Yeah. So one of the things I tend to spend quite a lot of my time is helping people with these projects called turnarounds. And these are basically where you've got a manufacturing asset that's working 24/7. And then every number of years, probably somewhere between 2 and 5 years, you shut down that manufacturing asset and do the vast majority of your maintenance, your repairs, refurbishment in one big project. So that project may be somewhere between 4 to 8 weeks long, maybe involving anywhere from 500 additional people to over 5,000 additional people. And critically, I guess the piece that they all have typically in common is there is a very, very large business driver to make that as short as possible, and to speed up all of those activities and make sure the plant comes back online as quickly as possible. Bigger assets, that could be multi-million dollars a day of lost profit opportunity. So massive business drivers to try and reduce the duration of these events.
Do you, during that phase, if there is any more than process, but let's say line changes or whatever, do you do much prevention by design through that phase?
Hopefully not during that phase, but yeah, certainly very much up front of that phase. So one of the typical kind of bits around these types of projects is that you do have the opportunity to plan for them a long time in advance. So if you do that planning properly, so potentially if you're on a long cycle turnaround, so maybe every 4 or 5 years, you could be planning for 4 or 5 years for that. So that does give you, if you do it right, the opportunity to get all of that design right. Up front of the modifications.
It's interesting listening to those people numbers as well, Matt, because people is always the thing that interests me and intrigues me. What are some of the challenges then about having that number of people involved in one of these projects?
I guess there's a number of different challenges. So one of which is actually being able to find enough people of the right level of competence and awareness to be able to fulfill those requirements. And when you're talking at those very big numbers, certainly in some parts of the world, that can be very challenging because they're just not available locally. So you typically will end up having people who have a lower level of competence and certainly a lower appreciation around safety. And therefore, you're having to have a higher level of supervision to be able to manage that effectively, a higher level of planning, a higher level of instruction to be able to be effective in those kind of environments. And then you've just got a whole lot of things happening at the same time. So simultaneous operations is one of the biggest challenges of doing these types of events because you've got so many things happening in immediately adjacent to each other.
I was going, and you said it earlier about when we were discussing this about sort of practical tips. What are some of the practical tips then for sort of handling, particularly that quantity or number of people in that situation?
So for us, I guess it's all about kind of planning. It's all about being able to think about this stuff a long time in the future, and that's always the challenge that organizations have: is that this stuff. Typically that you're talking about when you're planning these major events is something that's happening quite a long time in the future. And there's always something more urgent to be looking at and always a reason to not think about this big event that might be still 2 years away. But that's the, I guess that's the difference between people who do this kind of thing very well, people who don't do it so well and have major problems in executing that is those who can actually spend that time and invest that time in understanding and really thinking about how they're going to undertake that and working through all of that complexities as much as possible up front of an event.
How is kind of thinking about that transition? If it's a hypothetical company that is struggling, wanting to transition, let's say from an operation standpoint, because of difficulty. So that aspect of turnaround more than just the maintenance side, are you vested? I mean, I guess, how is your role with EHS during that transition? If it is becoming something different, not just like a line change, but if it's a process change for a company starting to do something different, how are you, is that playing a role into that as well? Sorry, I'm throwing a curveball. Curious. I'm curious because work with that obviously, but been fortunate, that hadn't been a heavy aspect of my background because I'm not in manufacturing, for example, heavy.
So I don't get involved in that specifically, but I do need to, because I'm sat kind of more with the kind of the overall management and processes of the event. So I just need to be aware that it's happening. I need to be aware that that is a risk that is there and needs to be managed. And I would typically just be helping the management of the organization in their awareness of that type of a situation, as opposed to needing to manage the specifics of it.
I know we sort of touched on timescales earlier. How do you find those sort of timescales affecting people's approach to safety as you're going through this turnaround event?
So I think there's a few things in there, because one is that because of the timescales, because of the kind of fact that this does not happen necessarily very often, people are not experienced in doing it. It's not something that people do very often. And you'll typically get into an event where it's a lot of people's first experience of doing something that's like that. And it's so fundamentally different to the rest of what they do. So having to be able to understand all the different both engineering but also safety implications of what's happening is really complicated for them, and because they just do not have that learning cycle ability to be able to improve and to do better by naturally kind of experiencing it happening. The other thing you find is that just the intensity of the events and the amount of pressure that's put onto that's felt by the organization because of the business requirement to move quickly and to get things started up as soon as possible puts quite a lot of pressure onto people, and also causes due to the elongated kind of period of it, these events will be working 24/7. Although obviously no one's working a full 24-hour shift, they'll be working long days and generally finding it very difficult to switch off and get rest from that situation. So by the time you get 4 and 6 weeks into an event, you start to get people who are much less able to be able to perform at their best. They're very much fatigued, very much have a much lower level of being able to kind of understand everything around them and become very much more kind of narrow in their ability to be able to make decisions.
It's interesting that making decisions as well. And I suppose as you recognize that, Matt, is there something that organizations are kind of starting to do to actively try to deal with the fatigue that's occurring throughout the project?
It's one of the big challenges that we have, because it will be something that we talk about a lot up front of the event. And our concerns around fatigue actually are more around the management team than actually the people who are working, because it is those people that we need to have that kind of real broad understanding of what's going on. Actually, it's not that the people who are actually doing it on the tools are not getting tired at all. They may well be, but they've got a much narrower natural focus in what they're doing. So if they've got good supervision around and good management around them, that can help things. But it's the management team who are having to take those good quality decisions is always a problem. And the challenge is forcing people or encouraging people to be able to have enough adequate rest in the earlier stages of the event to make sure that they are ready to be able to manage the end. And in honesty, I don't know anyone who does it perfectly. Nobody has infinite resources to be able to get people to be able to be rested. And typically the amount of investment that people have in the event makes it very difficult for them to step away.
I was going to say, it's interesting. I was thinking about this just the other day, not in the same context, but actually the way that a lot of businesses, a lot of pressure comes from the top in terms of performance. That then drives the wrong behaviors in terms of people and then ultimately ends up driving the wrong results. And that can be across any sort of discipline within an organization. And trying to create that culture where there's still pressure, but people still actually recognize what's the best thing for me to do for not just the performance of the business, but my own health is a really interesting challenge, isn't it?
It really is. And even in organizations that are for kind of very kind of forward thinking in that, and the senior management are deliberately trying to not put that pressure onto the organization, the scale and the nature of these projects, the fact that people, some of the senior team will have been working on this for 2 to 4 years of their career, and therefore the outcome is actually hugely important for kind of the way that they feel about themselves, the way that their career from the future, because they haven't got another one of these in a few months' time to be able to do it a little bit better. It doesn't come around. So there's a lot of personal pressure that people put on themselves, even if it's not happening from externally in the organization. And it's very, very difficult to actually see how you are being impacted by fatigue as well and to recognize that you're under it. So it does take people external to yourself to be able to be able to explain that that's what's happening to you and to try and encourage you to be able to take the rest that you need.
Take the break. Yeah, that's why I find it so fascinating, is it's such a different way of life to the norm, isn't it? Where people have this sort of daily thing that they're coming in to do and they see sort of daily, weekly results as a part of that. Whereas in your world, it's very different, isn't it? And particularly, I suppose, if somebody's a consultant or a contractor, actually their life is almost broken down into 3, 4, 5 year chunks, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it can definitely be in that way, yeah.
Well, and then you think about the transition. So even working with quite a bit of manufacturing, heavy construction, laboratories, things, any change when you start seeing, anyway, that's a huge aspect of human performance. So how can we manage that? And you start thinking about SIFs, so serious injury fatalities, fatigue, stress are some of the leading indicators around that, just primarily because if I'm stressed at home, work doesn't know it, it's usually going to create some adverse effect on the workplace, that whether inherent, whether fortunate, unfortunate, sometimes people, you can use that in a focused sense for a little while, but a lot of times you start thinking about the tiredness. I mean, that can be worse than, you know, alcohol inhibition, things like that. I mean, don't get me wrong, that can get excessive. I don't mean that, but from the attentiveness that you're able to put and you think about that, I mean, how many factors do we have outside of work that play a role to work? And this is potentially could be a volatile transition. So if you're not abreast, if you're not staying as focused as possible, that can be a recipe for issues.
Absolutely. And in many situations, people find themselves in kind of high stress situations. You have the ability to be able to learn and get better at that, because you can get yourself some experience in being in those situations over time. And these types of projects, it's actually quite difficult to get that kind of experience. So you've got a lot of people who are just not used to putting themselves in that kind of situation, suddenly feeling things that they've never felt before, and understanding that they've not being able to deal with before. So that kind of that ability to be able to practice, to be able to get better at it, is really quite challenging in these types of projects.
Well, you know, when you think about that, that was Tiger always said, Tiger Woods in a golf, he always said that what he knew he could do better was preparedness. And you'll see how I'm applying. I always talk golf, but in this sense, preparedness and being able to manage emotions, feelings. I mean, he's like, yeah, I'm nervous like anyone else, but I knew how to prioritize that. So I had to do my goal. I had to do the job that was before me. I think that's a mindset shift, honestly, that I think a lot of people can kind of learn. What are different exercises? What are things to just, whether good or bad, sometimes you have to compartmentalize. And that's challenging, it seems like, more and more as younger generation and others, that's sometimes they want to wear it on their sleeves. And sometimes you have to, you know, compartmentalize and figure, how can I focus on what I need to do?
And it's funny, isn't it? Because physiologically, a lot of us don't really understand how we're going to react in certain situations, do we? And I know when I'm playing golf, as soon as the word competition is mentioned, Langdon's smiling here because he knows what's coming, but it goes to pieces. It's like if you're going to walk out on stage to make a presentation, you might have practiced it so much at home, but the one thing you can't practice is that fight or flight feeling when you get up on stage and there are 200 expectant people looking at you. And I suppose the same in this situation, isn't it? That you can't really prepare for maybe the end of a 6-8 week period when you've been at it sort of with that kind of level of pressure for all that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can't, it's very difficult for us to kind of allow people to be prepared by exposing them to that situation. So we will just keep coming back to the fact is how do we just become as planned and as good at doing things in a procedural way as possible, so they can just be reliant on the fact that we're following a process, we're following a system, and we are as aware as we can be about things before we go into them, so people can be as effective as possible without needing to necessarily be as aware of everything that's going on around them.
I'm curious a little bit, if it's hypothetical, and I guess hypothetically, let's say it's an underperforming environment, and that's the reason strictly for that. Do you see the people that you're working with, the organization as a whole, we'll say culture in this sense, more challenging to work with during that transition versus a different maybe organization that's doing a turnaround, maybe not as much for strictly, let's say, for underperforming, but the market changes and they're having to. Do you see a journey differential from an EHS perspective that, I mean, obviously it's being kind of led down? You hit on that earlier, but I'm curious. So it really doesn't matter where I am regionally, but organizationally, do you see that being more challenging?
Typically, it's not one of the biggest factors. I mean, most of the time, these events are actually driven by regulation. So a government will say, you need to stop at this plant. You need to do internal thorough inspections of equipment. And that's what's driving it, as opposed to necessarily the performance of the overall asset. So typically the biggest things that affect this type of thing is actually organizational culture. Those are the things that you'll start to see come out under pressure much more obviously. So if you've got just a good organizational culture, something where the departments work well together, people are generally supportive of each other and work well with each other and want to help each other succeed. But when you get into these kind of events, then they can utilize all of that culture and be very, very effective in supporting each other. When you have a different organization that's maybe much more siloed in its working practices, there's potentially kind of a lot of defensiveness between departments, and potentially some history of difficulties. This kind of an event will just break those things apart, and that's the kind of thing that will just really start to cause the event to fall over when those cracks really start to appear.
It is interesting that cultural piece, isn't it? And it's, I suppose, that's a challenge in any business, is how you create that sort of culture to succeed. And it doesn't matter what business you are, you need that sort of cross-functional sort of working if you're going to do things effectively. I was interested as well, Matt, in terms of when you're finishing a project, if you're wrapping up a turnaround, is there a retrospective focus at that point to sort of say, right, what were our lessons learned? And then who would you share that information with?
Yeah, typically these events have quite a strong focus on these kind of things because you don't naturally do that. You've got to be much better at recording the lessons learned, and it's a difficult process to happen. I mean, just psychologically, you will find people that just want to compartmentalize and put that thing away in a box and don't want to go and think about it again because it's just painful for them. Even if it's a successful event, it will have been hard, it'll have been difficult, and it'll have been a lot of kind of tension and stress they'll have to deal with. And people just don't want to look back on it and don't want to think about it. But certainly, I'm actually walking into next week doing exactly one of these. I'm going to spend an entire week with an organization reflecting and learning on what has gone well with their latest turnaround and what they think could go better, and developing an action plan with them to make changes organizationally with their processes and procedures for which will improve their next event, which will be probably in around about 3 years' time.
Thank you for listening to part one of our conversation with Matt Gibson. Join us again in a couple of weeks' time when we will carry on this interesting discussion.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Two Bald Guys Talking Safety. Don't forget to follow and subscribe wherever you stream your podcast, or you can visit us at evotix.com.
And if you've liked today's podcast or you found some value from it, we'd really appreciate it if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review or a rating. It really means a lot to us. Thank you.